Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Beyond glycemic control, navigating PBS updates in diabetes care.
Welcome to today's podcast. I am Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane. It has become clear in the last few years that SGLT2 inhibitors are not just diabetes drugs, but cardiovascular and renal disease modifying agents. A recent major change to the PBS funding now provides GPs an opportunity to expand the use of SGLT2 inhibitors for those high-risk type 2 diabetes patients who would benefit the most. On 1st December 2024, PBS restrictions for dapagliflozin were expanded to allow treatment in combination with metformin, unless contraindicated or intolerant, with no glycemic requirements for patients with type 2 diabetes and high cardiovascular risk, or those who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders. Today, we are talking to Professor Jonathan Shaw, who is Deputy Director at the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute and Council Member of the Australian Diabetes Society. Professor Shaw will give us his insights on the implications of this expanded access to SGLT2 inhibitors for high-risk type 2 diabetes patients. Welcome, Professor Shaw.
Hi, Anita. Good to be with you.
So there's been a raft of changes to the PBS restrictions for type 2 diabetes medications in 2024. But hot off the press, the change made in December 2024 for dapagliflozin was a major step forward. Could you briefly run through what changed in this update?
Yes, so there have been a lot of changes over the last 12 months, and it can be difficult to remember exactly where we are with these. I think the best place to start is where we were prior to this change, where we broadly had three categories of subsidy for SGLT2 inhibitors. The earliest that we've been using, really since they became available, is as a glucose-lowering agent for people with type 2 diabetes. And to qualify for that, you had to have an HbA1c of more than 7%. Subsequent to that, we had added categories for people with heart failure and people with chronic kidney disease, and that was irrespective of diabetes status. And that's been helpful as well. That still left us with a substantial proportion of people with diabetes who were at high cardiovascular risk and yet didn't have the elevated glucose levels, the high HbA1c, that gave them access to these medications through the original indication, which was for glucose lowering. And it's that group that the most recent changes, beginning on the 1st of December, 2024, has included. So what we now are able to do is for people with type 2 diabetes who are at elevated cardiovascular risk, and that's defined either by having had a previous cardiovascular event or by being at an increased estimated risk of cardiovascular disease over the next 5 years, or in fact, if they are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders, then irrespective of their HbA1c, an SGLT2 inhibitor can be used and will be subsidised by PBS. And this is a really important benefit and a really important advance in the way that we're able to treat people with type 2 diabetes.
So could you shed some light on how this change to the listing for dapagliflozin actually came about and your thoughts on that, and why was it necessary?
Well, there's been accumulating evidence now for a good number of years that among people with type 2 diabetes, these agents will reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, heart failure, chronic kidney disease in people who are at elevated cardiovascular risk. And critically, this benefit for cardiovascular and renal outcomes is not dependent on the glucose-lowering effect of these drugs and is not restricted to people who have high blood glucose levels. So really what this is doing is enabling the funding of a treatment for type 2 diabetes to catch up with the evidence and allows us, at least for dapagliflozin, to prescribe this for people who are at elevated cardiovascular risk, even if their glycemic control is quite adequate. And it also helps us, and I think this is a really important part of what this will do, it helps us to remember to separate cardiovascular risk protection from glycemic control. They're both critically important in people with type 2 diabetes, but we don't necessarily use all the same strategies to do one as we do the other. And doing one does not necessarily mean we are doing the other and achieving the other.
That's a great point. So improved access to SGLT2 inhibitors now therefore has the potential to change the treatment trajectory for our type 2 diabetes patients early in their disease journey. Now, before we tease the clinical implications out further, could you give our audience the key headlines on what this change will now mean for GPs?
Yes. So for the group of people with type 2 diabetes who have a prior cardiovascular event, we're talking about MI, stenting, angioplasty, stroke, symptomatic peripheral arterial disease, they can qualify through that. They can qualify through an increased risk based on the cardiovascular risk calculator. And for that purpose, for that indication, the person needs to have a risk of cardiovascular disease that is at least 10% over the next 5 years. And there was last year an update to the Australian cardiovascular risk calculator that can be used for that. That would be the second group of people. And the third group of people are those who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And if a person has type 2 diabetes and falls into any one of those three categories, then they can be prescribed dapagliflozin on the PBS irrespective of their HbA1c. And in that setting, it is being used to reduce their cardiovascular risk. It will, of course, help to improve glycemia, but its primary effect there will be the very important thing of reducing cardiovascular risk.
Mm-hmm. So unpacking what you've just told us, we know that diabetes and cardiovascular disease often coexist, and it's a particularly dangerous combination. Hence, I think as GPs, we need to really be looking at these at-risk patients, which you've defined so clearly for us. They need to be identified early and managed proactively. And we need to think of using these medications earlier. Now, the dapagliflozin is available for us to use in that high-risk patient. So we need to really be thinking of now not being restricted anymore as we used to be by the A1C requirement. Now, Professor Shaw, how do GPs now keep this on top of mind to be using this treatment sort of algorithm?
So I think that this facilitates something that has actually been recommended in guidelines now for a number of years. And that is that when a person with type 2 diabetes walks into the clinic room, one of the first things you need to ask yourself is what is their cardiovascular and their renal risk. If their cardiovascular risk is elevated, either because they have had a cardiovascular event or because their estimated cardiovascular risk is elevated, then we need to be thinking of a range of interventions. We need to be thinking about statins. We need to be thinking about blood pressure lowering agents, particularly with ACE inhibitors or ARBs. We're used to doing that. We're used to thinking cardiovascular risk equals a statin. Cardiovascular risk equals RAS blockade with an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. And for some people, that cardiovascular risk equals aspirin or antiplatelet therapy. Now, we can add to that list that cardiovascular risk equals treatment with an SGLT2 inhibitor for people with type 2 diabetes. And now for dapagliflozin, that decision is subsidized by PBS.
That's such an excellent tip to think of it in those terms. Then we will definitely be using these drugs much more proactively.
And Anita, I think it's important that we separate that question about cardiovascular risk from the next question that we have to ask ourselves, which is what about glycemic control? And these are two overlapping but slightly separate questions that we have to ask ourselves.
Yes. And essentially what you're saying is, you know, we've got to really move away from that age-old glycemic focus only for our type 2 diabetes patients. And like you said, every time a patient walks in, think about their cardiovascular risk and attend to it. Now, given that patients for whom we can now prescribe an SGLT2 inhibitor may already have an A1C below 7% because of this new listing, some listeners might be wondering if one can go too low by using SGLT2 inhibitors in this scenario. So are there any safety or tolerability concerns with this early combined therapy approach?
So, of course, it's always really important to think about the downsides. It's easy to talk about all the benefits, but it's really important to consider the downsides and the side effects. So, of course, all the usual side effects that we're used to with SGLT2 inhibitors are just as relevant in this population as they are in the people that we have been treating for a number of years. So that's fungal genital infections, it's risk of ketoacidosis, particularly in the setting of surgery or starvation and dehydration. But the particular issue that you raise here about the possibility of hypoglycemia also needs to be borne in mind. Now, for this purpose, we really need to divide treatments and drugs for diabetes into two groups. There are those that have a potential to cause hypoglycemia, and those that effectively don't. So the ones that can cause hypoglycemia are sulfonylureas and insulin. The rest of the interventions that we use, whether they be lifestyle or other medications, SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1s, DPP-4s, etc., thiazolidinediones, metformin, they don't really cause hypoglycemia. So if you add an SGLT2 inhibitor to medication that doesn't include a sulfonylurea or insulin, you don't need to worry about hypoglycemia. Now, you might decide that for pill burden, it seems reasonable to stop, let's say, a DPP-4 inhibitor and substitute an SGLT2 inhibitor. That might be a reasonable decision, though not one that's driven by safety concerns. But certainly, if the HbA1c is below 7% and the person is on a sulfonylurea or on insulin, I would be either stopping one of those or certainly reducing them.
So can we now try and put this opportunity that's now arisen with the new PBS listing that was going to change our practice into context?
I think that this new indication, this expansion of the subsidy really helps to push through the message that there are agents that we have, SGLT2 inhibitors and also GLP-1 agonists, which are beneficial for cardiovascular and renal risk. And it helps to emphasize what I was talking about before, about this separation in our minds between two overlapping but somewhat separate questions about dealing with treating the risk and dealing with lowering and controlling glucose. And whilst there is overlap of those two, they are not the same thing. And I think that this is actually going to get the message out that dealing with cardiovascular risk is really important and isn't just dealt with by lowering glucose.
Yeah. So really, I'm hearing that there's a great opportunity for GPs now to do a much more comprehensive risk mitigation strategy with our type 2 diabetes patients and make a difference. Now, as we are looking at prescribing two medications, say, for example, metformin and SGLT2 inhibitors for these high-risk patients without worrying about the A1C anymore, does the new listing also include the use of fixed-dose combinations? Because as you can appreciate, these FDCs or fixed-dose combinations are popular for fostering greater patient adherence and reducing cost and pill burden for our patients.
Yes, I think this is an important point, actually, and one that we haven't quite touched on yet, which is that the particular listing that we have is, in fact, in combination with metformin. Now, of course, that doesn't apply if there's a contraindication or intolerance to metformin. But outside that, the PBS requirement is in combination with metformin. And obviously, that can be done as separate prescriptions, or it can be done as a fixed dose combination. And there are advantages of both fixed dose combinations. Some people like the idea of starting things off with a fixed dose combination. Sometimes it's easier to persuade patients of the need for two drugs if they're combined into one tablet. Other perspectives on this, I think, take a different view, which is that maybe it's better to start initially with separate ones. If you do have problems with tolerance, then it can be a little bit easier to stop one and continue the other whilst you work out which agent is causing the problem with tolerance. And practitioners, I think, are used to this sort of thing. Of course, we have fixed dose combinations in many different areas of medicine. It's not just in diabetes. And so I think, importantly, the opportunity is there and the flexibility is there for individual practitioners to tailor this to the patient that they are dealing with at that time.
Yeah, that's really good practical advice. Well, Professor Shaw, thank you for taking us so eloquently and comprehensively through the latest changes to the PBS listings for SGLT2 inhibitors for type 2 diabetes management. Could you please summarise the main points for GPs to take from our discussion today?
Yes, I mean, so the main point really is we now have this additional indication, this additional subsidy for SGLT2 inhibitors, and particularly for dapagliflozin, for people with type 2 diabetes who have an established history of a cardiovascular event or who are at least a 10% risk of cardiovascular disease over the next 5 years, as estimated by a cardiovascular risk estimator, or who are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, and that this particular reimbursement is not dependent on HbA1c and therefore can be used for people who have an HbA1c which is otherwise deemed to be within acceptable limits, more specifically is less than 7%.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you, Anita.
Please note the PBS information for Forxiga, dapagliflozin. Forxiga is available on streamlined authority for type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and heart failure. Refer to the PBS schedule for full details. Before prescribing, please review the full product information. The substantiating references and product information can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with AstraZeneca and produced in January 2025. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.